Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Capuano's telephone community meeting. We thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Allison, and I'll be moderating tonight's discussion. Thank you for being with us. If at any point during tonight's discussion you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, just press star 3 to begin that process. At some point later this week, we will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website in case you miss any portion of tonight's discussion. To access that file or to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit our website at www.house.gov/Capuano. If you do have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press star 3 to begin that process. And with that, I'd like to turn the meeting over to Congressman Capuano. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I just want to welcome everybody who's joined us on the call tonight. I hope that if you stay with us for a few minutes, you'll find it informative and enlightening, and hopefully we'll have a good discussion on the issues of the day. Just as a way of introduction, while we have some people who might want to call in for questions, I do want to say a couple of things. First of all, I'd like to take a moment to remember that today is Pearl Harbor Day and to thank all of the veterans that have put their lives on the line to protect our way of life. Pearl Harbor Day obviously is an important event in our history, but days like this also should just remind us that we still have men and women who are serving to protect us and to distinguish their brave and wonderful action from some of the policy differences we might have that might send them into action. And I know that most of us are more than capable of doing that. I also want to just talk for a minute about what's going on in Washington. I'm sure that most everyone who's listening stays aware of the things that are reported on the news. And you all know that we're struggling with how to deal with our excessive deficit and our massive debt burden. And there are significant and important differences between how to approach it. Some would simply slash every single government program there is, regardless of who gets benefits, or some of the poorest amongst us might get hurt. And there are others of us who would prefer a more balanced approach. We understand we have to tighten our belts on some things, but we also think that we can't do it without some thoughtful increase in revenues. There are many ways to do that don't hurt average people, and understanding that for the benefit of a better society, most of us are more than happy to provide a few more dollars. So it doesn't mean that anyone enjoys paying taxes. It just means we recognize it as the price of a civil society. And we're going to have that debate. It's not going to be over shortly. Everybody thought that maybe it was done with the super committee, but people who pay attention understood no matter what they did, even if they, quote, succeeded and came out with a plan, that wasn't the end of it. It was just the beginning. We will have this debate for the next year or more as to where to make those cuts. There are some who are already trying to say, well, we can't have those cuts in defense, and there are others trying to say, well, we can't have those cuts in fuel assistance or food stamps or whatever it might be. And there are still very few of us who think that we need to increase revenues in order to balance these books. But nonetheless, that debate's going to be part of the major election coming up. I'm sure that by the time next November comes up, most people will be tired of hearing the differences of opinion. But they're not small differences, and they're not the kind of differences that can easily be worked out. These are significant policy differences that touch on basic philosophical beliefs about what we want in our country. And I ask everyone a couple of questions. First of all, do you think that we were better off before the Bush tax cuts, or do you think we're better off now? I would argue that our economy was stable, or the employment rate was manageable, and that people were heading in the right direction before the Bush tax cuts. And I think that's proof positive that cutting taxes in and of itself doesn't guarantee a good economic outcome. And the other part of it is to remind people to ask themselves always, what kind of a country do you want to live in 10, 20, or 100 years from now? What do we want to leave behind? It's not just about how we feel today, this moment, and the instant gratification. It's also important that we leave a country behind for our children and our grandchildren that they can be proud of and that will provide for their essential needs, things like Social Security and Medicare, to make sure that something's there when they need it so that they don't have to start all over again. And I think with that, I think that's a reasonable introduction. And if we have people who are ready to ask questions, I guess I'm more than happy to let's have some fun.
We do have some questions waiting, and if you are just joining us and you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, just press star 3 to begin that process. And we are joined tonight by Kirk from Somerville, who would like to talk about defense spending. Kirk, your question for the Congressman?
Yes, and I wanted to say that I'm a longtime supporter of the congressman. I think he does great work on Capitol Hill, and I applaud all of his efforts. I would like to ask about efforts to cut military spending, which is euphemistically, of course, just much of it referred to as defense. We spend the United States spends more on the military, I believe, than every other nation in the world combined, and of course, most of that has nothing at all to do with defending the country. So I would like to see, I would like to ask the congressman how he feels we might go about cutting military spending for non-essential programs, of which there are many, 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 so that we could put that money and also the Bush tax cuts, which mainly benefited wealthy folks, we could put that money back to work for the middle class and the rest of us.
Thanks, Rick. Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think everyone I know wants a strong military and a strong defense system. No one that I know that's thoughtful would oppose that, because there are people in the world that would take advantage of that. At the same time, we all know that there are things in the military that are just ridiculous, particularly the cost. A classic one, in my opinion, is the Star Wars approach. I, for one, think that it is a good thing to do the research to have an appropriate defense system for Star Wars, so that if we ever needed it, we could build it in a reasonable period of time. However, since there are no threats to us at the moment that the Star Wars would ever defend against in any real sense of the word, it's an incredible waste of money to try to build it out, and that's what we're doing. That's just one example. Another one is our airplanes. There is no country in the world that can come close to touching us in the air. And yet we are insistent on building another jet that's even faster and stronger and better than the one we have, at the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars. And the only reason to do that is so that we can sell the old jets, namely they're not old, but the ones that we're using now, so we can sell those across the world and somebody can make a profit. I would argue that the American security and the American economy is more important than the profit of a few corporations. Those are just two simple examples. There are lots of things we could do, and the result of the lack of the super committee coming up with something will be, at the moment, if the current law is, a $600 billion cut in defense. And I will be honest with you, I personally think that's probably a little bit more than we should be doing, but it will at least put the issue on the table so that we can have an honest discussion about it. There are many people, John McCain being the most prominent voice down here, who says he's guarantees we won't make those cuts. Well, the president has said that, as far as he's concerned, the deal was a deal and we're going to stick to it. So that will be a major point of debate. As far as the Bush tax cuts, I've said all along that I didn't vote for them at the beginning. I didn't vote to extend them, and I will not vote to extend them again. I have no problem extending the tax cuts for middle-class people and poorer people, and I'm not trying to soak the rich. I want to be real clear. I think that is a mistake to use that rhetoric. There's nothing wrong in this country with being wealthy and having a few extra dollars. My answer is God bless those people. At the same time, most of the people that I know that would fall in that category are happy to pay a few more dollars to maintain the society we know. So I think that that's going to be a major point of debate over the next year. And, Kirk, I think you've hit on two very important topics that you will be hearing a lot about in the next year or so.
If you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, press *3. Paula from Somerville is joining us now, and she would like to talk about taxes. Paula, your question for the Congressman?
Hi, Congressman. First of all, thank you for everything you've been doing.
Thank you.
But secondly, I know this sounds crazy, but I know that my husband and I could afford to pay more taxes. 1 or 2 or 3% more would not kill us. And there are so many needs in this country, and I don't understand why the Republicans don't understand this, and why we're only talking about millionaires, because there are so many of us who are not millionaires who can help, and there are so many who need help.
Well, I love you, and I honestly think that I'm very, very lucky to come from a district where many people share that sentiment. And that's why I have thought that the president's initial call when he was running for office of people making $250,000 above. I actually thought that was too much of a compromise to begin with. I was willing to accept it because, you know, the president's the leader of our party and I have to be part of a team. But my own personal approach would be to make that number a much, much lower. Not because I'm trying to tax people. I don't like doing it either. But I'll give you a classic example. We're about to cut fuel assistance with the winter coming upon us. Everyone in New England understands what that means for the poorest people in our society, and I don't know anyone who wants anyone else to freeze in their own home. And that's just one example. So, Paula, I personally happen to agree with you. Again, I would probably take one minor exception to some of the lowest income people in the society. And I am willing to compromise the amount. I'm not stuck on whether it should be a cutoff of $20,000, $50,000, $100,000, or $250,000. That's the nature of politics, and I will make a compromise. But the concept that you have outlined, I think, is 100% correct. If we really believe in a civilized society, if we really want all the programs we claim to want, then we have to be willing to provide a few more dollars, and that's really all it is for most working people. And, again, no one wants to. But I don't think anyone's lifestyle is going to change for a few dollars a week, and a lot more than that for people who are on the upper end. So I happen to agree with you, Paula, but at the same time, the political reality is that even if we get something, we're probably going to have to draw a line in the several hundred thousand dollar range. But that, again, that's the nature of political compromise. And for me, something is better than nothing. So if I have to, I will, but I will not lie about it. I will tell you it's a compromise.
If you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, press *3. Joanne from Alston is joining us now with a question about services for children with disabilities. Joanne?
Hi. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Good.
I have a question about children with disabilities as they get older.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering if there's anything that the country could do to help the employers give them incentives to maybe give them tax cuts when they hire older children with disabilities, and about housing, what's available in services for housing for these
right.
kids.
Well, I'll tell you, Joanne, if it sounds like you might have a family member in that situation. If that's the case, I would encourage you to call the office tomorrow and have a more personal discussion. Maybe we can point you in the right direction how to get started. But as a general answer, I will tell you that there are lots of proposals to do that. At the same time, we're also fighting proposals to cut the services and the benefits that already go to those children, which I think is amazingly insensitive. None of these kids, none of these families who face these difficulties have ever asked for this situation. And anyone, as far as I'm concerned, who doesn't understand that children like that and adults like that, because they will become adults, are really part of our society, and no family should be asked to deal with that on their own. But as a member of society, I feel an obligation, even though they're not my children, thank God, but they are members of my society. They're my neighbors. They're the children of my friends and my neighbors and my family, and I feel a very strong obligation to take care of them. And I think that anyone with a heart has to agree with, again, that general approach. So there are some programs out there. They are part of the discussion down here to both increase some of those services and to decrease some of those services. No one will ever put it that way, but those cuts to disability through Social Security would do just that. But Joanne, I just want to state again, if you have a specific family member that needs some help or a friend, I would encourage you to call the office tomorrow, and maybe we can help point you in the right direction.
Lyndon is joining us now from Somerville, and he has a question about health care. Lyndon, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Hi, Mr. Mayor, Mr. Congressman. I'm particularly going at health care.
Mm-hmm.
Because when this thing came in, I think there was a great opportunity missed here. The same way we're using the federal savings account, I'm looking at this. Say a constituent has from 1 to 5 years, and they've been saving money, and they haven't been using it because they're not getting sick, which means I think that should be a great thing for the country. My take on this is, wouldn't the government or the Congress think this true to say, well, then, this person is not a burden on the society, so instead of the IRS holding on to this money, why couldn't the government roll this over, and if it goes to year 5, that becomes a tax break, and I'm sure the middle class would jump at this a whole lot, why not become a tax break for the participants of the country, because they're not a burden on the healthcare system?
Well, I'd have to get more details on that proposal, and I'm not sure I follow all the details. But if you're suggesting, we have something called what are they called, health accounts, health service accounts, HSAs. I think that's the name of them, but it's something like that. And they allow people to put money aside for health insurance. At the same time, most healthcare needs don't come over a period of time. They come one fell swoop. All of a sudden, you know, I'm healthy for 10, 20, 30, 50 years, and all of a sudden I get cancer, and now all of a sudden it's going to cost $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 to deal with it. And that's the issue with health insurance. It's not about only sick people paying for health insurance. It's about the pool of everyone chipping in a few dollars, not because obviously if everyone's sick, you'll never have enough money. But the idea is that for those of us who remain healthy, that we help support those who are sick at the moment, knowing that when it's our turn to get sick, which will come, others will be able to provide for us. That's the whole basic idea, the whole basic approach of health insurance. So if you have specifics on that proposal, and then I'd have to see them to give you a specific answer. I followed you a little bit, but I'd have to know a lot more to be able to give you a specific answer.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, press *3. Joe from Somerville is joining us now, and he has a question about MF Global. Joe, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Yes, good evening, Congressman. I'm just calling regarding MF Global with John Corzine. There's $1.2 billion missing,
yep.
And basically, are you going to be on the committee when he speaks in front of Congress? If so, what questions are you going to ask, and also, what do you feel should be done to him?
Right.
Why isn't he in prison at this time?
Well, I mean, he's just accused. I mean, that's, if some of these allegations turn out to be true, like anybody else, he will be in prison. But we're at the beginning stages of that, and that's not what Congress says. That would be the Justice Department or someone else. The answer is yes. My committee, I'm on financial services, and I'm actually the ranking Democrat on that subcommittee, and we just today voted to subpoena Mr. Corzine. We're having a hearing next week on MF Global, and we will have a series of hearings because there's a lot of information to ask. This investigation is just at the beginning stages. I mean, I've read as much as I can read about it. I've talked to some people trying to figure out exactly what happened and why. And it raises some serious questions. But I want to be honest. If there is criminal wrongdoing, that's a bad thing, and there will be a punishment. And that's of interest. But my bigger interest is whether this situation indicates that the financial services industry has already found a way around all the new regulations that we have put in. And I don't know the answer to that. So for me, that's the direction I'm going to pursue. There are other people who are better qualified than I, the Justice Department and others, to determine whether Mr. Corzine or others committed a crime. I mean, there are criminals everywhere, including on Wall Street, and it does happen. But for me, my interest is how does this play in the greater economic and greater financial services scheme? If it's just one bad actor doing one bad thing, that's a bad thing, and I'm not going to forgive it. But it's not the crisis. I'm more concerned if how many other MF Globals might there be out there. And I'm not suggesting there are any. I don't know. But that's my biggest concern, and those are the questions I'll be pursuing.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Jay from Somerville is joining us now with a question about transportation funding. Jay, your question for the congressman?
Sure. Thanks, Congressman, for all your work in D.C. Really appreciate it here in Somerville. I was just curious, because I know there's been a lot of talk about potential Green Line extension to the Somerville area, and, you know, there's been debate about federal funding for that and how that's moving along and whether we got it from other states, et cetera. Could you give us an update as to how that's coming along and whether there's any future for the Green Line in Somerville?
Sure. I mean, well, there's really a couple questions in there. One is general federal funding for transportation. We are having that fight regularly down here. The most transportation infrastructure, subways, roads, bridges, things like that, most of it is paid for through your federal gas tax, which is 18.3 cents, I think it is, per gallon. The problem, good and bad, is that most of us are driving more fuel-efficient cars and driving less. So the trust fund, the highway trust fund funded with that gas tax, has been going down and down during a period when, of course, construction costs go up and up. So we can do a lot. We get less, and we can do less with it. which is why the whole transportation system has been slowed down all across the country. So that's the general answer. We are fighting that battle now. There are many of us who think we have to generate revenue to keep that trust fund going. I think our transportation system is one of the major reasons why we have a great country. It's certainly not the only one, but it is a major reason. And if we let it crumble or we don't continue to expand it as our population grows, the country will come to regret it very quickly. As far as the Green Line in specific goes, yes, it could be eligible federal funding. It's too early to tell yet. That's the goal for everyone because it could be 50% to 80% federal money. And as far as I'm concerned, I think that the biggest problem right now is not the federal funding, not for the Green Line. The biggest problem is whether the state has the matching funds. I mean, when you get federal money, you don't get 100% of the dollars. But the state has to match it, and again, it's usually in the 50-50 range or 80-20 or whatever the number might be. So the state has to come up with their share, and the state is the one with the significant financial limitations on that issue. I mean, the federal government has it too, but they would have the money for this project. And that's been my fear in the Green Line for several years now, is that I think the governor is very well-intended. I think everyone in Somerville wants it. I think most people in Medford probably want it. The problem is that if we wait for the state to fund the whole thing, I'm afraid we'll end up with nothing. I think the city of Somerville and the people of Somerville should formulate a plan that we all can get behind to get as much as we can while we can, with the idea being something's better than nothing. If the state or the federal government dries up in 2, 3, 5, or 10 years, we'll at least have something. And I think that we need to be concerned about whoever the next governor might be. I think Governor Patrick has been very committed to this project, and I'm hoping whoever the next governor will be equally committed, but I can't guarantee that. So that's been my push, and I will tell you that I will not stop pushing for the Green Line at all. I've been very active on it, and I will continue to be so.
If you're just joining us tonight and have a question for Congressman Capuano, press star 3. Victor from Somerville is joining us now with a question about campaign finance. Victor, your question for the congressman? I think we lost
Hello?
Victor.
Oh, sorry.
We have Robert from Cambridge with a question about jobs.
Actually, it's Teresa from Cambridge.
Teresa.
Computers, Teresa, computers.
That's okay. My question is, we have so many resources and so many young college graduates who are in their early 20s and unable to find jobs in this economy.
Right.
What are we doing to produce more jobs?
Right now, I don't think we're doing near enough. We are having major debates down here because the majority in the House, the Republican majority, believes that the best way to create jobs is to cut taxes of the wealthiest and corporations. I personally, and we're the minority in the House, but we've been able to stop these things in the Senate. I actually think that that's a recipe for disaster. I think the only way to help create jobs is, yes, some targeted tax things to encourage job creation, but we have to get this economy moving. And in the meantime, I've been a long-time proponent of a WPA type of approach. It's not foolproof, but it worked before, it can work again, and it is a short-term targeted approach to it, at the end of which we have new roads and bridges and subway systems to show for it. At the same time, that takes an investment, and we cannot get the other side to agree to put any money on the table to hire anyone. I think that it has been proven time and time and time and time again that tax cuts, though good, don't stimulate the economy. And I stated this in my opening statements, but I'll do it again, is I ask everyone, before the Bush tax cuts, how was the economy? And I know the answer to that. The answer is the economy was moving forward. Everybody, not everybody, but most everybody had a job. People in the age of 20 had some future to look forward to and a good job to begin with. And things were moving in the right direction. And the minute we started with the Bush tax cuts, I mean, it wasn't the only thing, but all we did is we just sent a lot of income to a smaller percentage of people. If we want to stimulate the economy, I think the government has to participate in that by creating direct jobs. And the best way to create direct jobs, in my opinion, is infrastructure, because they're quick jobs. They can be done. They can be measured. You can see them. They pay reasonably well. And at the end of those jobs, you have something to show for it. You have a bridge or a green line or whatever it might be. But that's a major debate. And that it's awfully hard to find compromise there. Because the other side says, no, we won't raise revenue anywhere, and we only will accept tax cuts. And I will tell you honestly that to me, I don't think it'll work. I think it's bad for the economy. I think it's been proven repeatedly to be bad for the economy. And so, therefore, it's really going to be up to the American people, I think, in November, if they really want us to make progress, to elect people that will see it a little bit more enlightened way.
Dean from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about campaign finance. Dean, your question for the Congressman?
Hi, Representative Capuano.
Hey,
I think most of us who live in Cambridge and Somerville in this area don't have a prayer in the country anymore, given the influence of corporate dollars in government and determining the outcome of one budget area after another. You can look at industrialized agriculture, you can look at the banks, you can look at all of it. I think the only way to tackle this is to get money out of the elections so that we can elect people who aren't beholden on that money. Is there any hope of getting campaign finance reform back on the agenda of the American people? I don't think it's going to come out of Congress.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think so, only because we had a better chance at it last election because we had a Democratic majority and more people agreed, but we couldn't get it through the Senate. I will tell you that I'm a principal co-sponsor of the public campaign finance law proposal down here that we work with Common Cause and many of the other good groups on doing this. But I'm pretty realistic about it. I don't think it's going to pass this year. I'd be shocked if it did. But I also tell you that I agree with you. We don't have a prayer of competing dollar for dollar. The other side will outspend us every time. But people have to remember that money is important. I'm not going to say it's not, but it is not the only thing that's involved with elections. I'm living proof of it. When I ran for Congress, I had people who literally outspent me 10-1, and I was number 6 in money in the campaign out of 10. So you don't have to have more money than the other guy. You just have to have more people. And I want to remind people back in when FDR got elected, or even John Kennedy, you know, campaign contributions were in cash. They were directly from corporations, and they weren't recorded. And so you talk about big money those days, it was direct big money. And yet the people on occasion would get together and make progress. We created Social Security and Medicare and the Great Society and on and on and on. So I think it can be done. But those of us who are trying to make it better, we should continue trying, but we can't lose hope that our day-to-day efforts won't succeed. I think they can succeed, and if we get the right people in Congress, we can actually pass good laws, including this.
If you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Stan from Somerville is joining us now with a question about gridlock in Washington. Stan, your question?
Poor Congressman.
Hey,
how are you doing tonight?
Good. How are you?
I'm very well. My question is, I watch a lot of these appropriation hearings on CNBC or CNN when they're on and I have time. And one of the things that's fallen under the radar screen is when the appropriations were going through for some of the agencies, that the Republicans were trying to decimate clean air, clean water, and food safety. And I think that these are sacred things to me, and I wonder if there's something that can be done to take that aspect away from the appropriations hearings. And one little aside I have is, if you can give a message to Congressman Frank, we're all going to miss him terribly.
That's good. I'm sure he'd be happy to hear that. The answer is probably not. No, I mean, the appropriation process is here, and I think actually usually it's good because it does reflect the will of the American people. People have to remember that even when we don't agree with whatever the members of Congress do, that every single member of the House of Representatives in the history of this country has been directly elected by the people from their district. And all districts are approximately the same size. So it's pretty representative of the average American. You will get people to disagree. And at the moment, the last election was pretty clear. The country decided to go in a much more conservative way that wanted to cut spending, period, with no discussion about, you know, or no concern, I guess I should say, about the actual details. We just cut everything they could find. That's a result of an election. Elections matter. And for those of us who are concerned about these issues, we have to double down and get more involved in this society and elect people that see the world a little bit more closely to the way we see it. And I think that's the best way. I mean, I wouldn't want the other side to say, let's take it away from Congress if, you know, people like us were running the world. And we did, from give or take 1950 to 1990. A lot of programs were passed and passed relatively easily because America kept electing people time and time again that wanted an involved society. That has changed, obviously, and I think at some point the country will make a decision which direction they want to go in. Obviously, I've been pushing to go in a more open and more progressive direction. I think that more often than not, substantively, people will agree with us. And I think I wouldn't do this if I didn't hope that things could change. I do believe that will happen.
Clara from Somerville is joining us now with a question about affordable housing. Clara?
Yeah, hi. I work for the Community Builders, which is based in Boston, and we do affordable housing in 14 states. You probably have heard of TCB.
Oh, I know Community Builders very well.
Yeah, our CEO is retiring, which is, you know, our loss, but, you know, our new successor is going to do a great job. And I live in Somerville, and one of the sites we have as a company is located in Somerville. But one of the things I noticed from working there is that there needs to be more affordable housing because, you know, even though we do a lot of great work, sometimes the wait list for people is a year or two, and we have to go by HUD requirements to get people on the wait list in order to get them into the apartments. Is there any more money that you think is going to be freed up more on the transitional housing in terms of more short-term needs for people?
No.
I'm not even talking official for my job. I'm just talking
No, I understand. I understand. No, honestly, Clara, no, I think the answer is no. I mean, right now, every battle we're having down here is trying to prevent cuts to programs like that. There is virtually no attempt by people who are the majority here to increase spending on affordable housing. It's always the other way around. I will tell you that I've been in Congress 13 years now, and I've spent all but four of them every year fighting cuts in various housing programs. And we just have them well. We passed the HUD appropriation bill, 2 weeks ago, something like that, and there are cuts in the housing programs. We considered a major victory that they weren't devastating cuts, and I will tell you that there were some increases, but very, very few, mostly cuts. So I got to be honest with you, there will be some increases in certain small programs, but they will be offset by major cuts in other programs, and so therefore the concept of affordable housing, as far as I'm concerned, is seriously under threat.
Mary from Chelsea is joining us now with a question about Social Security. Mary?
Yes. Mr. Capiano?
How are you?
All right. I got a letter from you from the Notch. I'm 87 years old.
Yeah.
And I worked from 12 years old, and I worked till 70. I was 78. I'm 87 now.
God bless you.
And when it's something, and during the war, today is 70 years of Pearl Harbor. During the war, I worked in a defense plant for 7 days. Do you know how much I made for 7 days? $25, and I brought it home to my mother. We worked very, very hard years ago, and I hope that they don't take my Social Security away and my notch years. I worked, as I said, from 12 years old doing housework. Half the time, they didn't even pay me. I was the oldest of four children, but we all worked hard, and no one knocked on the door and said, here's $10. No one. So I hope that you can preserve our Social Security, and also I would love to get something for my notch years.
Well, I tell you, that my mother was a notch baby, and the likelihood of them changing that is probably not going to happen. But I will tell you that you won't find any politician, I don't think, on any party of any kind that will tell you that they don't like Social Security. The ones who didn't like Social Security realize that they lost that argument. However, there are still plenty of people down here that would like to privatize Social Security, and there are plenty of people down here that would like to attack Social Security from the back door, things like funding, cut the funding for it, therefore you don't change the program, you just starve it to death. And those proposals are seriously on the table. I don't want to scare anybody. I don't think they're going to pass in the near future, but the people that are trying to pass them have not given up, and I don't think that they will. So I think that Social Security is safe. It's certainly safe for your generation. I think it's a better question whether it's safe for mine, and a very much better question whether it's safe for my children. And I personally think that the people who passed Social Security didn't do it just for one or two generations. They did it so that no seniors ever in the history of this country going forward will ever have to suffer the way that people have in the past. So I can tell you that certainly the vast majority of us here will never harm Social Security, but there are those who will try to do it. They won't do it through the front door. They will try to do it through the back door. and I just don't think they're going to succeed.
Sylvia from Somerville is joining us now with a question about climate change. Sylvia?
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, hello, Congressman.
How are you?
I wanted to thank you so much for this platform. It's just a brilliant idea.
Thank you.
And I have two energy-related questions. One is kind of visionary, commonly talked about. The other is aesthetic in Somerville. But one is why, when we had a Democratic majority, was no climate change bill passed in Congress. And I wanted to give the perspective of someone close to me is working on a project for the Saudi Arabian government where they are building an entire city dedicated to renewable energy, housing scientists to research renewable energy, because they realize that in about 4 years they'll be using more than 60% of their oil production on their own people, and they want to be able to sell it. So if Saudi Arabia is realizing the need for renewable energy, how can we in America not realize the importance of it?
Right.
And then the aesthetic aspect is the power lines in Somerville. How can we get them buried underground? Because our trees are ruined, they look awful, and I think it would look so much nicer if we could just create jobs to bury those lines.
Right. I can answer the second one more easily. The second one, I'm the former mayor, I'm sure you know. It simply costs money to bury those lines. Somebody has to pay for it. You can't ask the utility user to pay for it if they don't live on that street. So the city would have to pay for it, and we did that on occasion. You'll see that most of the main streets have it buried. But the truth is it's very, very expensive, and it can only really be done when the whole street is being reconstructed like we just did Somerville Ave. And because of financial considerations, the average street doesn't get full-depth reconstruction very often. But the time to really fight for that, to be fiscally responsible, is when the street's being redone and the sidewalks are being redone so that you don't have to dig the streets up just to bury them and then have all kinds of problems from that. But it's really just an expense item. As far as why we didn't pass a bill, well, we did pass a bill in the House. That we couldn't get it through the Senate. And very simply, the Senate is an institution where because there are two senators from every state, there are two from California and two from Rhode Island, two from Texas and two from Maine. So, I mean, no matter how many people you have in the state, the Senate has two, each state has two, and the oil-producing and coal-producing states that get together on a regular basis, and they will have enough senators to block a lot of things. So I think that in many ways, if we really want to pass something, it is a classic example where those of us who, I happen to agree with you, Sylvia, especially from renewables, those of us who feel that way have to make compromises with people that don't agree with us. Otherwise, we will continue to lose. I mean, if you were the senator from Louisiana, you would not vote against the oil industry. If you were the senator from Pennsylvania, you would not vote against the coal industry. And many people in the South are big nuclear proponents because they have a lot of nuclear power down there. So that it's unfortunately the reality of politics, and like it or not, politics is government, and we have to understand that. So for those of us who really want to make progress, we have to find a way to cooperate with some people on issues that we don't agree with in order to be able to make progress on issues that we feel are important. And that's been very, very difficult on the environmental end because many of my environmentalists will not make a compromise with my coal enthusiasts. And my coal enthusiasts, of course, won't make a compromise with environmentalists. So there's been very little room for compromise. Everybody believes that they are right because they are right in their mind, and period. And the other side is, you know, just not paying attention to facts. We have people running for president who still deny climate change. They deny the science to it. So until we win the hearts and minds of the American people and understand the political realities, mostly in the Senate, in the House, it's simple majority. That's why we were able to pass it in the Democratic-controlled House. But in the Senate, we have to, even Democrats from Louisiana or from Pennsylvania have to vote different ways and if they want to represent their own people. And we have to learn ways to work with them so that they won't be seeing it as voting against their own interests.
David from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about Medicare. David?
Good evening. I wanted to ask about the $50 trillion of unfunded costs that we face with Medicare looking ahead over the next 50 years. Obviously, we can't address that right now. We're in the midst of a short-run economic crisis, But in the long run, we've got to somehow think about bringing the revenue stream. Oh, I apologize. My son just walked in.
okay.
To bring the revenue. Thank you. Bring the revenue stream in line with the extraordinary costs. So I'd like to know what your vision is in the long run. Max, you got to step out. I apologize.
Don't worry. I've had kids too.
In the long run, for addressing this imbalance.
Well, David, I'm glad you raised it because, you know, everybody gets concerned about Social Security, but the truth is Medicare and Medicaid are in much more difficult financial situation than Social Security and really have a very short window for us to address it. First of all, you have to understand there are many people in Washington who have always hated Medicare and Medicaid and would like to see them go away. They're the same people that voted to add Medicare Part D, the drug prescription drug proposal, without adding a single penny. So they added significantly to the cost, but nothing to the revenue. So the entire intention was to overburden the system with a good program, but nonetheless one that we will not be able to afford very long. So you're 100% right, and I think that we have to have some serious discussions. Part of it was discussed last 2 years with the health care bill. Some of that health care bill was the long-term goal is to deal with some of these issues because, and I'll be honest with you, David, this is one of the main reasons I am a single-payer proponent. I think there were some problems with that proposal as well, but overall, I really think that the entire country, everyone in the country, should be in one basic health insurance system. We're all healthy and sick at different times in our lives, and I just don't see why there should be different pools of people. I just think the insurance, the actuarial values work a lot better if you have one big pool, and that's the end of the discussion. And that's part of it. The other part of it is we have to have some honest discussions with ourselves as a society as to what we want to spend. It's pretty well documented, and again, don't hold me to the exact numbers, but something like 50% or 60% of the healthcare costs are spent in the last 2 years of life. And, you know, we have to understand that as a society. And I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do it, but if we want to provide our seniors, with the best possible healthcare, as a society, we have to pay for it. And if we can't pay for it, we have to have honest discussions about how to do that. And until we have those discussions, we will not be able to address these issues. I have not met a single person once ever who has ever said, well, me and my family will accept less health care or lower quality health care for the benefit of society. Everyone I know says, I want the best for my kids. I want the best for my mother or my spouse. And that's natural. That's human nature. But the best costs money. And that includes MRIs, that includes CAT scans, that includes drugs, that includes whatever you think is appropriate. So it's a difficult discussion, but it's one that until we have it, we'll never be able to really address the healthcare issues in this country.
Raven from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about mortgage reform. Raven, your question for the congressman?
Hi. Congressman. Thank you for doing this. I'm speaking from a personal point of view, which is I've gone through several years of efforts to have my mortgage made more affordable. But in general, I would say the thing that has confused me most is, you know, you talk about all these different programs that you don't have the funding for, and that becomes a very political and difficult area to work in. But the programs that the government set up to help people like myself to be able to afford our mortgages by having them mitigated, having the mortgages renegotiated so that something like myself could afford them, this has been a real problem because it appears to me that the programs that the federal government set up for the banks to give the banks incentive to help people are not being followed by the banks, and the banks are not getting any pressure, or if they are, I haven't been able to see any evidence of it, any pressure from the government to go ahead and actually use these. I've just talked to an enormous number of people, organizations, and they all say the same thing. The bank doesn't really make much money out of doing this, and as a result, they have no incentive. And what I don't understand is why were the guidelines for whatever their use of the program, and I specifically referred to the program called HAMP, which is relatively straightforward, which is that if a person fits certain guidelines, they should be able to have their mortgage mitigated or changed. Anyway, what I don't understand is why would this program pass and put into effect, and yet it's not being in any way mandatory for the banks to do this sort of thing. I got rejected, even though I fit the HAMP guidelines perfectly, and they gave me no reason, no explanation at the end of 2 years of waiting for this. And I think that it leaves people like myself who could desperately use this help really wondering why, you know, I even bothered to try.
Well, I mean, Raven, I agree with you. We tried a few programs at the beginning of the mortgage crisis that we all thought would help, and they turned out not to be what we wanted, so we keep trying, and we keep coming up with new ones. You just mentioned one, the HAMP program. But and now, you're right, they are voluntary, and they are voluntary because the truth is the government has limited ability to impact. What a mortgage is a contract between the homeowner and the mortgage lender, mostly a bank, but not always a bank. Matter of fact, not even usually a bank. But it's a contract between two entities. And it's awfully hard for the federal government to impose its will on a voluntarily entered into contract. It'd be like buying a car or anything else. So what we can do is we give the banks incentives to do it, but we can't require them to do it. Don't forget that the banks also have to answer to their investors, and they have to answer to the people that have bought these mortgages to be able to produce the rates that they have. So they have to do that. And that's been part of the problem. I personally think that the government should be a little bit more forceful. And I want to be clear, there are certain things we can do and certain things we probably can't do, even though they sound good politically. Most notably, I think it would be very difficult for the government to ever reduce the principal on a residence. I think that's a real interference with the contract and would probably never be held up in court. However, I think what we could do is to require certain entities to renegotiate for the sake of discussion. You don't change the principal. You can change the term of the loan. You can lower the interest rate. You can stretch that loan out over a longer period of time so that the monthly payments are more manageable. There are lots of things that can be done. But right now, honestly, Congress doesn't have the will to impose anything. We're fighting day to day against repealing half of the new regulations that we put in. The Republicans hate the concept of government regulation, and people like me say thoughtful government regulation is oftentimes a good thing, and the lack of regulation is what got us in trouble in the first place. So I can tell you that I think that Democrats probably were a little too timid in the first year or two, thinking, well, you know, this will work. And now that Democrats no longer run the place, the likelihood of being able to force the mortgage companies to do something is probably not very high. But I can only tell you on the specific, if you qualified, you should have been accepted. Obviously, I don't know the details, and if you want, please feel free to call the office tomorrow, and we'll see if we can help with some of the details. No promises, but we can certainly try our best to help.
Yusuf from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about student loans. Your question for the congressman?
Yes, I do. Thank you for your service, Congressman Capuano, first of all. I'm a Cambridge resident, and I attend Suffolk University in Boston. And my question is about student debt and more specifically about the threat to Pell Grants in a possibly fully Republican controlled Congress. Many of my classmates and I, we work 20 or 25 hours a week in addition to school. Many students drop out. So what hope do we have for assistance from Congress in terms of possible student debt relief or help with grant programs?
Pell Grants, we did increase Pell Grants a little bit in the last couple of years, but now they're under threat of cuts again. And you're right to be concerned about it because there's been, again, that's one of the many social programs that, you know, some people think need to be cut. I personally think that an educated society is in all of our best interests. I don't know you, Yusuf, but your education is important to me, not just as a politician, but as an American. I want you to be educated so that you can have a better job and keep our economy moving forward, and not just you, your entire generation and the next generation. So I personally think that it's something good for us to try to make college affordable to as many people as we can. Obviously, that view is not shared by everybody down here. So the Pell Grants are under threat. As far as other things, I mean, we did, with all the problems we had a couple of years ago, I never liked the idea of moving college loans into the private market. Not because I have anything against the private market, but again, they're motivated by profit, and they should be. So therefore, they will cost more to get a private loan than would a government subsidized loan. And again, since I believe that higher education is the benefit of the society, I think student loans, when I was in college, student loans were government loans. And the rates were fixed, and they were fixed at 3% for as long as it took me to pay them off. And now when my son has loans at the 7 and 9% range, and those rates don't change. And that's, you know, that's he's been out for a few years, and that's part of it. So all I can tell you is, Yusuf, that is part of the big discussion down here as to whether we should be involved as a society, and I happen to think we should. I would like every student in America, honestly, to be engaged in this because they have a direct interest in the outcome of this debate. Give you an example, right? There is no exception to Pell Grants or any other student programs on this sequestration across the board of 10%. So there will be a cut. If we don't take some action in the next year, there will be a cut of 10% to Pell Grants next year. That's, in my mind, the wrong way to go for this country. And I would think that every student in America who either gets or knows people who gets a Pell Grant should be upset about it and should be engaged in it.
We have time for just a couple more questions this evening. If we do not get to your question, we apologize. But anyone on the call who would like to leave a question or a message for Congressman Capuano will have the opportunity to do so at the end of this telephone community meeting. We have Terry from Cambridge joining us now with a question about the defense authorization bill. Terry, your question?
Yes. Thanks, Congressman, for your incredible service and this call. My question, I'm a 9/11 family member, and since 9/11, though, I've been devastated to see how much of our own American values we've ceded, I feel, to terrorism, you know, in the rule of law, allowing indefinite detentions without trial and torture in the name of the need to fight terrorism. And I think it undermines our government, and I was concerned about the National Defense Reauthorization Act and the provisions proposed in that that allow for, in fact, require indefinite detentions, if I'm correct, supposedly until the war on terrorism ends, which seems like never.
Right. Well, thanks, Terry. First of all, it's, I'm sorry for your loss on 9/11. I mean, it was a terrible tragedy, and a lot of us felt along with you. I will tell you that I really appreciate your comments because that is exactly why I voted against the Patriot Act. I think the terrorists won a significant victory when this country turned against itself and took our own freedoms and rights away and turned our back on some of the values that we have. Look, if anyone is accused of terrorism, as far as I'm concerned, they deserve, you know, the swift and severe punishment. I don't have any problem with that. But I don't understand why any country would want to hold people indefinitely. If we have caught terrorists and we have brought them to this country, which is fine by me, then we should try them. And if they're guilty, we should punish them. And if they're not guilty, we should let them go. And it's kind of amazing. Even in Guantanamo, we have let hundreds of people just go. And that, which to me is just amazing. No one ever wants to talk about it. But if they were so bad that they had to bring them to the most secure prison on the face of the earth, then why would we just let them go? I don't understand it. And we would sometimes let them go after a year or 2 years or 5 years, and it makes no sense. I certainly don't feel safer for it. I don't feel that the country is well served by it. Again, I don't think I'm soft on terrorism. I voted to send troops to Afghanistan. I would vote tomorrow to chase al-Qaeda and other terrorists around the country. The other day at a public forum, I even defended killing the terrorist American citizen in Yemen, not because I liked it, but because I thought it was a necessary evil in this particular war. At the same time, I don't feel that way about just simply holding people who are suspected of being terrorists. If they're terrorists, let's try them, let's punish them. And if they're not, then we shouldn't. As far as torture goes, again, I understand maybe the needs on a battlefield. I guess I would distinguish some actions that's the spur of the moment and the heat of battle, but I don't understand why anyone thinks that the torture would work after you've taken somebody, you know, 4,000 miles away and it's 3 months later. What useful information are you going to get from them? and I don't understand it. All kind of experts have said that you're not going to get anything useful. All I can tell you, I think it has diminished this country. As far as I'm concerned, I'm ashamed of some of the things we have done. I will do everything I can do. I voted against the Patriot Act and every extension of it to try to bring us back to the honor, which to me is the great freedom and the civil liberties that this country stands for, and I think is what makes us strong. So, I commend you for your comments, Terry, and I can only tell you I'm doing what I can, but it is the significant minority. There are very few of us who feel that civil liberties and human rights still trump pretty much anything else.
And that is just about all we have time for this evening. We thank everyone very much for participating. If we did not get to your question, we apologize, but you will have an opportunity to either leave a question or if you have a comment for Congressman Capuano, you'll have the opportunity to leave that message at the end of this community meeting. We will be posting an audio file on our website if you missed any portion of the meeting, and you can locate that at www.house.gov/Capuano. And I know Congressman Capuano would like to say goodnight as well.
Well, thanks, Allison. I want to thank everyone who listened in tonight. Again, as I said at the beginning, I hope you found it informative, and I don't expect anyone that will agree with me on every point that I made. That's not the measure of representation. The idea is that people feel as though, at least even when we disagree, that it's a thoughtful disagreement and that we can talk to each other. I think that's the way government should work. That's the way representation should work. And I want to thank all of you who took the time to listen in tonight and ask questions and think these things through with us as well. So with that, I'll simply say good night and God bless and Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Happy Hanukkah to everyone.